Good evening, friends, and welcome to Sleepy Tom Tales, a podcast aimed at helping you to get a good night's sleep. Do you find your mind plagued with the stresses of modern life, especially when the lights are out and you're trying to get a restful night? Does your spinning mind keep you awake? Follow my voice down the path towards a good night's rest. Listen to me tell a story that will keep your mind from wandering to your daytime problems, the ones you can't solve right now and will be easier to solve while rested. Listen to my voice and allow yourself to drift, following the twists and turns of the story, but slowly letting go, then drifting into sleep. Before we go on with the show, I'd like to ask you for a little bit of support. If you're finding Sleepy Tom Tales useful to you to help you get to a good night's sleep, and you have the inclination, and you can afford to, you can help me keep it ad-free and going out to thousands of insomniacs just like you. You can do this through supporting on Patreon at patreon.com/sleepytimetales. This is monthly support that not only helps me keep the lights on, but can get you fun bonuses based on your contribution. From as little as $2 a month, you get weekly access to early release on the main episodes, so you usually get your fresh sleep aid on a Wednesday instead of a Sunday. And $5 a month gets you weekly bonus minisodes, special edits, and a monthly megasode, which is all the week's releases in one big listen. A big welcome to Pam, who's the newest member of the Patreon family. She signed up last week. Welcome to the Sleepy Tom Tales team, Pam. I'm very grateful for your support. Thank you very much. But of course, monthly support might seem a big ask, so you can make once-off tips through buymeacoffee.com/sleepytimetales or the tip jar on the website. I also have some basic merchandise in a Tee Public store which you can reach through the show notes or via the website, sleepytimetales.net. But while money is handy, and is after all how I pay for things, it's not the only way to help. You can help Sleepy Tom Tales grow simply by spreading the word. You can help me in my mission to give more people a restful night's sleep, to help me do my small part, to do our small part in improving their lives. If you tell people on social media, please make sure to tag me at Sleepy Tom Tales on Instagram or Twitter, so I can see and I can thank you. Last but not least, of course, is the shout out to the music, which is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiku. Their stuff is available on their website at royaltyfreakmusic.com. There's a lot of very cool stuff on there, most of which is available for commercial use, public domain style. So if you'd like to use music in a creative project of some kind, take a look. And with that, better move on. Thank you for taking the time. Let's get back to the show. So what exactly is Sleepy Tom Tales? What is it for? What is this strange thing, this strange idea, this podcast that you're supposed to fall asleep to? But in the 21st century, lack of sleep is a health crisis. And this is a podcast intended to help those that it can to get a restful night. Do you find yourself lying awake at night, mind spinning and emotions in turmoil with the anxieties of 21st century life? Do you wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself not quite able to doze back off at 3 a.m? I'm here to help. My name is Dave, and I'm your narrator, here to help you into a restful night. Sleepy Tom Tales is intended to be used as a distraction to what keeps you awake at night, or maybe sometimes background noise or simply company. That's why I make these episodes quite long, so that I'm here for you, without any pressure of the end coming. Now, as far as I know, there are a couple of different ways to engage. The primary idea is that it gives you something to focus on, a story or an event that lets you keep your mind on a specific point, to stop it from spinning out into stress and anxieties, to focus just enough not to resist the embrace of a night's sleep when it comes for you. In the second way, some people just need some kind of background noise. In this day and age, people like white noise generators or some kind of sound. Could be the ocean, wind in the trees, or maybe just some boring dude droning on in the background. But however you're engaging, with the Sleepy Time Tales. The important thing is that you don't try to force the sleep. Just keep a light mental grip on the thread of the story and allow the need for sleep to come for you. Now, obviously, I'm hoping you're asleep before I get to the end of the episode, but it's important that you don't feel pressurized. If this is your first night with us, this actually probably won't work for you. It'll probably take a couple of nights. I recommend giving it a solid 3 nights to see if you can get used to it. If you can get used to listening to my voice, getting used to my accent, getting over the strangeness of the whole idea of just letting some person talk to you until you fall asleep. It's also possible, especially early on, that one episode isn't long enough. Or maybe your problem isn't so much going to sleep. Maybe you fall asleep and find yourself waking up in the middle of the night. What I recommend in that case is that you just keep on listening. Download a whole bunch of episodes into your podcast app of choice. Start with the latest, or rather put them on a playlist first off. Start with the latest and let them play. That way, if you find yourself lying awake, staring at the ceiling, you just pop your earbuds back in and go back to sleep again. You can even do the same thing if you wake up before your alarm, 60 minutes or as little as 30 minutes. And it may sound strange. What's the point of an extra 30 minutes of sleep after all? But I've had people actually thank me for the suggestion, because the truth is, allowing yourself complete relaxation right before the alarm is satisfying on a whole new, deep, deep level. It's important as you listen, though, to relax. If you're new to the show and prone to late nights lying staring at the ceiling, this may seem strange to you. So just ask that you give it a chance. Because I'm here to work with you. To create a safe space. A cocoon in which you can curl up and allow nature to take its course. So if you're still with me, thank you for staying. If you're already asleep, we'll chat again soon. And of course you aren't hearing me, except maybe in a dream. Tonight we return to Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. There was no doubt that they had the upper hand. However, there was so much more at stake than the liberty or even the lives of Dion and myself, that I did not deem it expedient to accept their offer without giving the matter a careful thought. Without the great secret, this maleless race must eventually become extinct. For ages they had fertilized their eggs by an artificial process, the secret of which lay hidden in the little cave of far-off valley where Dion and I had spent our honeymoon. I was none too sure that I could find the valley again, nor that I cared to. So long as the powerful reptilian race of Pellucidar continued to propagate, just so long would the position of man within the inner world be jeopardized. There could not be two dominant races. I said as much to Dion. "You used to tell me," she replied, "of the wonderful things you could accomplish with inventions of your own world. Now you have returned with all that is necessary to place this power in the hands of the men of Pellucidar. You told me of great engines of destruction which would cast a bursting ball of metal among our enemies, killing hundreds of them at one time. You told me of mighty fortresses of stone which 1,000 men armed with big and little engines such as these could hold forever, against 1,000,000 Sagoths. You told me of great canoes which move across the water without paddles, and which spat death from holes in their sides. All these may now belong to the men of Pellucidar. Why should we fear the Mahars? Let them breed. Let their numbers increase by thousands. They will be helpless before the power of the Emperor of Pellucidar. But if you remain a prisoner in Putra, what may we accomplish? What could the men of Pellucidar do without you to lead them? They would fight among themselves, and while they fought, the Mahars would fall upon them. And even though the Mahar race should die out, of what value would the emancipation of the human race be to them without the knowledge which you alone may wield, to guide them toward the wonderful civilization of which you have told me so much, that I long for its comforts and luxuries as I have never before longed for anything. No, David, the Mahars cannot harm us if you are at liberty. Let them have their secret, that you and I may return to our people, and lead them to the conquest of all Pellucidar. It was plain that Dian was ambitious, and that her ambition had not dulled her reasoning faculties. She was right. Nothing could be gained by remaining bottled up in Putra for the rest of our lives. It was true that Perry might do much with the contents of the Prospector, or Iron Mole, in which I'd brought down the implements of outer-world civilization. But Perry was a man of peace. He could never weld the warring factions of the disrupted Federation. He could never win new tribes to the Empire. He would fiddle around manufacturing gunpowder and trying to improve upon it until someone blew him up with his own invention. He wasn't practical. He never would get anywhere without a balance wheel, without someone to direct his energies. Perry needed me, and I needed him. If we were going to do anything for Pellucidar, we must be free to do it together. The outcome of it all was that I agreed to the Mahar's proposition. They promised that Dian would be well treated and protected from every indignity during my absence. So I set out with 100 Sagoths in search of the little valley which I had stumbled upon by accident, and which I might and might not find again. We travelled directly towards Sari, stopping at the camp where I had been captured. I recovered my express rifle, for which I was very thankful. I found it lying where I'd left it when I'd been overpowered in my sleep by the Sagoths, who had captured me and slain my Mezop companions. On the way, I added materially to my map, an occupation which did not elicit from the Sagoths even a shadow of interest. I felt that the human race of Pellucidar had little to fear from these guerrilla men. They were fighters, that was all. We might even use them later ourselves, in the same capacity. They had not sufficient brain power to constitute a menace to the advancement of the human race. As we neared the spot where I hoped to find the little valley, I became more and more confident of success. Every landmark was familiar to me, and I was sure now that I knew the exact location of the cave. It was at about this time that I sighted a number of the half-naked warriors of the human race of Pellucidar. They were marching across our front. At sight of us they halted. That there would be a fight I could not doubt. These Sagoths would never permit an opportunity for the capture of slaves for their Mahar masters to escape them. I saw that the men were armed with bows and arrows, long lances and swords. So I guessed that they must have been members of the Federation, for only my people had been thus equipped. Before Perry and I came, the men of Pellucidar had only the crudest weapons wherewith to slay one another. The Sagoths, too, were evidently expecting battle. With savage shouts, they rushed forward toward the human warriors. Then a strange thing happened. The leader of the human beings stepped forward with upraised hands. The Sagoths ceased their war cries and advanced slowly to meet him. There was a long parley during which I could see that I was often the subject of their discourse. The Sagoth's leader pointed in the direction in which I told him the valley lay. Evidently, he was explaining the nature of our expedition to the leader of the warriors. It was all a puzzle to me. What human being could be upon such excellent terms with the guerrilla men? I couldn't imagine. I tried to get a good look at the fellow, but the Sagoths had left me in the rear with a guard when they had advanced to battle, and the distance was too great for me to recognize the features of any of the human beings. Finally, the parley was concluded and the men continued on their way, while the Sagoths returned to where I stood with my guard. It was time for eating, so we stopped where we were and made our meal. The Sagoths didn't tell me who it was they had met, and I did not ask, though I must confess that I was quite curious. They permitted me to sleep at this halt. Afterward, we took up the last leg of our journey. I found the valley without difficulty and led my guard directly to the cave. At its mouth, the Sagoths halted and I entered alone. I noticed as I felt about the floor in the dim light that there was a pile of fresh-turned rubble there. Presently, my hands came to the spot where the great secret had been buried. There was a cavity where I had carefully smoothed the earth over the hiding place of the document. The manuscript was gone. Frantically, I searched the whole interior of the cave several times over, but without other result than a complete confirmation of my worst fears. Someone had been there ahead of me and stolen the great secret. The one thing within Pellucidar which might free Dion and me was gone. Nor was it likely that I should ever learn its whereabouts. If a Mahar had found it, which was quite improbable, the chances were that the dominant race would never divulge the fact that they had recovered the precious document. If a caveman had happened upon it, he would have no conception of its meaning or value, and as a consequence it would be lost or destroyed in short order. With bowed head and broken hopes, I came out of the cave and told the Sagoth chieftain what I had discovered. It didn't mean much to the fellow, who doubtless had but little better idea of the contents of the document I had been sent to fetch to his masters than would the caveman who had in all probability discovered it. The Sagoth knew only that I had failed in my mission, so he took advantage of the fact to make the return journey to Putra as disagreeable as possible. I did not rebel, though I had with me the means to destroy them all. I did not dare rebel because of the consequences to Dian. I intended demanding her release on the grounds that she was in no way guilty of the theft, and that my failure to recover the document had not lessened the value of the good faith I had in offering to do so. The Mahars might keep me in slavery if they chose, but Dian should be returned safely to her people. I was full of my scheme when we entered Putra, and was conducted directly to the great audience chamber. The Mahars listened to the report of the Sagoth chieftain, and so difficult is it to judge their emotions from their almost expressionless countenance, that I was at a loss to know how terrible might be their wrath, as they learnt that their great secret, upon which they rested the fate of their race, might now be irretrievably lost. Presently, I could see that she who presided was communicating something to the Sagoth interpreter. Doubtless something to be transmitted to me which might give me a forewarning of the fate which lay in store for me. One thing I had decided definitely. If they would not free Dion, I would turn loose upon Putra with my little arsenal. Alone, I might even win to freedom. And if I could learn where Dion was imprisoned, it would be worth the attempt to free her. My thoughts were interrupted by the interpreter. The mighty Mahars, he said, are unable to reconcile your statement that the document is lost with your action in sending it to them by a special messenger. They wish to know if you have so soon forgotten the truth, or if you are merely ignoring it. I sent them no document, I cried. Ask them what they mean. They say, he went on, after conversing with the Mahar for a moment, that just before your return to Putra, Huja the Sly One came, bringing the great secret with him. He said that you had sent him ahead with it, asking him to deliver it and return to Sari where you would await him, bringing the girl with him. Dian, I grasp. The Mahars have given over Dian into the keeping of Hooja. Surely, he replied. What of it? She's only a Gilak. As you are, would say, she's only a cow. Chapter 6. A Pendant World. The Mahars set me free as they had promised, but with strict injunctions never to approach Putra or any other Mahar city. They also made it perfectly plain that they considered me a dangerous creature, and that having wiped the slate clean insofar as they were under obligations to me, they now considered me fair prey. Should I again fall into their hands, they intimated it would go ill with me. They would not tell me in which direction Hooja had set forth with Dian, so I departed from Putra, filled with bitterness against the Mahars and rage toward the Sly One, who had once again robbed me of my greatest treasure. At first I was minded to go directly back to Anorak, but upon second thought turned my face toward Sari, as I felt that somewhere in that direction Hooja would travel, his own country lying in that general direction. My journey to Sari, it is only necessary to say that it was fraught with the usual excitement and adventure, incident to all travel across the face of savage Pellucidar. The dangers, however, were greatly reduced through the medium of my armament. I often wondered how it happened that I had ever survived the first 10 years of my life within the inner world, when naked and primitively armed I had traversed great areas of her beast-ridden surface. With the aid of my map, which I had kept with great care during my march with the Sagoths in search of the Great Secret, I arrived at Sari at last. As I topped the lofty plateau in whose rocky cliffs the principal tribe of Sarians find their cave homes, a great hue and cry arose from those who first discovered me. Like wasps from their nests, the hairy warriors poured from their caves. The bows with their poison-tipped arrows, which I had taught them to fashion and to use, were raised against me. Swords of hammered iron, another of my innovations, menaced me, as with lusty shouts the horde charged down. It was a critical moment. Before I should be recognized, I might be dead. It was evident that all semblance of intertribal relationship had ceased with my going, and that my people had reverted to their former ways, their suspicious hatred of all strangers. My garb must have puzzled them too, for never before, of course, had they seen a man clothed in khaki and puttees. Leaning my express rifle against my body, I raised both hands aloft. It was the peace sign that is recognized everywhere upon the surface of Pellucidar. The charging warriors paused and surveyed me. I looked for my friend Guk, the hairy one, king of Sari, and presently I saw him coming from a distance. Ah, but it was good to see his mighty, hairy form once more. A friend was Guk, a friend well worth the having, and it had been some time since I had seen a friend. Shouldering his way through the throng of warriors, the mighty chieftain advanced toward me. There was an expression of puzzlement upon his fine features. He crossed the space between the warriors and myself, halting before me. I did not speak. I did not even smile. I wanted to see if Guk, my principal lieutenant, would recognize me. For some time he stood there looking me over carefully. His eyes took in my large pith helmet, my khaki jacket, and bandoliers of cartridges. The two revolvers swinging at my hips, the large rifle resting against my body. Still I stood with my hands above my head. He examined my puttees and my strong tan shoes. a little the worse for wear now. Then he glanced up once more to my face. As his gaze rested there, quite steadily for some moments, I saw recognition, tinged with awe, creep across his countenance. Presently, without a word, he took one of my hands in his, and dropping to one knee, raised my fingers to his lips. Perry had taught them this trick, nor ever did the most polished courtier of all of the grand courts of Europe perform the little act of homage with greater grace and dignity. Quickly I raised Gok to his feet, clasping both his hands in mine. I think there must have been tears in my eyes then. I know I felt too full for words. The King of Sari turned towards his warriors. "Our Emperor has come back," he announced. "Come hither and..." But he got no further, for the shouts that broke from those throats would have drowned the voice of heaven itself. I had never guessed how much they thought of me, as they clustered around, almost fighting for the chance to kiss my hand. I saw again the vision of empire which I had thought faded forever. With such as these I could conquer a world. With such as these I would conquer one. If the Sarians had remained loyal, so too would the Amazites be loyal still, and the Kalians, and the Suvians, and all the great tribes who had formed the federation that was to emancipate the human race of Pellucidar. Perry was safe with the Mesops. I was safe with the Sarians. Now if Dion were but safe with me, the future would look bright indeed. It did not take long to outline to Gok all that had befallen me since I'd departed from Pellucidar, and to get down to the business of finding Dion, which to me at that moment was of even greater importance than the very empire itself. When I told him that Huja had stolen her, he stamped his foot in rage. "It is always the sly one," he cried. "It was Huja who caused the first trouble between you and the beautiful one. It was Huja who betrayed our trust, and all but caused our recapture by the Sagoths that time we escaped from Putra. It was Huja who tricked you and substituted a Maha for Dion when you started upon your return journey to your own world. It was Huja who schemed and lied until he had turned the kingdoms one against another and destroyed the Federation. When we had him in our power, we were foolish to let him live. Next time..." Gok did not need to finish his sentence. "He has become a very powerful enemy now," I replied. "That he is allied in some way with the Mahars is evidenced by the familiarity of his relations with the Sagoths who are accompanying me in search of the great secret. For it must have been Huja who I saw conversing with them just before we reached the valley." Doubtless they told him of our quest, and he hastened on ahead of us, discovered the cave and stole the document. Well does he deserve the appellation of the Sly One. With Gok and his headmen, I held a number of consultations. The upshot of them was a decision to combine our search for Dion with an attempt to rebuild the crumbled Federation. To this end, 20 warriors were dispatched in pairs to 10 of the leading kingdoms, with instructions to make every effort to discover the whereabouts of Huja and Dion, while prosecuting their missions to the chieftains, to whom they were sent. Gok was to remain at home to receive the various delegations, which we invited to come to Sari on the business of the Federation. 400 warriors were started for Anorak to fetch Perry and the contents of the prospector to the capital of the Empire, which was also the principal settlement of the Sarians. At first it was intended that I remain at Sari, but I might be in readiness to hasten forth at the first report of the discovery of Dion. But I found the inaction in the face of my deep solicitude for the welfare of my mate so galling that scarce had the several units departed upon their missions before I too chafed to be actively engaged upon the search. It was after my second sleep, subsequent to the departure of the warriors, as I recall, that I at last went to Guk with the admission that I could no longer support the intolerable longing to be personally upon the trail of my lost love. Guk tried to dissuade me, though I could tell that his heart was with me in my wish to be away, and really doing something. It was while we were arguing upon the subject that a stranger, with hands above his head, entered the village. He was immediately surrounded by warriors and conducted to Guk's presence. The fellow was a typical caveman, squat, muscular and hairy, and of a type I had not seen before. His features, like those of all the primeval men of Pellucidar, were regular and fine. His weapons consisted of a stone axe and knife, and a heavy knobbed bludgeon of wood. His skin was very white. "Who are you?" asked Guk, "and whence come you?" "I am Kolk, son of Gurk, who is chief of the Thurians," replied the stranger. "From Thuria I have come in search of the land of Amoz, where dwells Dakor the Strong One, who stole my sister, Kanda the Graceful One, to be his mate." "We of Thuria had heard of a great chieftain who has bound together many tribes, and my father has sent me to Dakor to learn if there be truth in these stories, and if so, to offer the services of Thuria to whom we have heard called Emperor." "The stories are true," replied Guk, "and here is the Emperor of whom you have heard. You need travel no further." Kolk was delighted. He told us much of the wonderful resources of Thuria, the land of awful shadow, and of his long journey in search of Amoz. "And why," I asked, "does Gurk, your father, desire to join his kingdom to the empire?" "There are two reasons," replied the young man. "Forever have the Mahars, who dwell beyond the Liddy Plains, which lie at the further rim of the land of awful shadow, taken heavy toll of our people, whom they either force into lifelong slavery or fatten for their feasts. We have heard that the great emperor makes successful war upon the Mahars, against whom we would be glad to fight. Recently has another reason come. Upon a great island which lies at the Sojar Az, but a short distance from our shores, a wicked man has collected a great band of outcast warriors of all tribes. Even are there many Sagoths among them, sent by the Mahars to aid the wicked one. This band makes raids upon our villages and is constantly growing in size and strength. For the Mahars give liberty to any of their male prisoners who will promise to fight with this band against the enemies of the Mahars. It is the purpose of the Mahars thus to raise a force of our own kind to combat the growth and menace of the new empire, of which I have come to seek information. All this we learned from one of our own warriors, who had pretended to sympathize with this band, and then escaped at the first opportunity. "Who could this man be?" I asked Guk, "who leads so vile a movement against his own kind?" "His name is Hujar," spoke up Kolk, answering my question. Guk and I looked at each other. Relief was written upon his countenance, and I knew that it was beating strongly in my heart. At last we had discovered a tangible clue to the whereabouts of Hujar, and with the clue, a guide. But when I broached the subject to Kolk, he demurred. He had come a long way, he explained, to see his sister and to confer with Dakor. Moreover, he had instructions from his father which he could not ignore lightly. But even so, he would return with me and show me the way to the island of the Thurian shore, if by doing so we might accomplish anything. "But we cannot," he urged. "Hujar is powerful. He has thousands of warriors, He has only to call upon his Maha allies to receive a countless horde of Sagoths to do his bidding against his human enemies. Let us wait until you may gather an equal horde from the kingdoms of your empire. Then we may march against Huja with some show of success. But first must you lure him to the mainland. For who among you knows how to construct the strange things that carry Huja and his band back and forth across the water? We are not island people. We do not go upon the water. We know nothing of such things. I couldn't persuade him to do more than direct me upon the way. I showed him my map, which now included a great area of country extending from Anorak upon the east to Sari upon the west, and from the river south of the Mountains of the Clouds north to Amaz. As soon as I had explained it to him, he drew a line with his finger, showing a sea coast far to the west and south of Sari, and a great circle which he said marked the extent of the land of awful shadow in which lay Thuria. The shadow extended southeast of the coast out into the sea halfway to a large island, which he said was the seat of Huja's traitorous government. The island itself lay in the light of the noonday sun. Northwest of the coast and embracing a part of Thuria lay the Lidi Plains, upon the northwestern verge of which was situated the Maha city, which took such heavy toll of the Thurians. Thus were the unhappy people now between two fires, with Huja upon one side and the Mahas upon the other. I did not wonder that they had sent out an appeal for succor. Though Gak and Kolk both attempted to dissuade me, I was determined to set out at once. Nor did I delay longer than to make a copy of my map to be given to Perry, that he might add to his that which I had set down since we parted. I left a letter for him as well, in which, among other things, I advanced the theory that the Soja Oz, or Great Sea, which Kolk mentioned as stretching eastward from Thuria, might indeed be the same mighty ocean as that which, swinging around the southern end of a continent, ran northward along the shore opposite Putra, mingling its waters with the huge gulf upon which lay Sari, Amos, and Greenwich. Against this possibility, I urged him to hasten the building of a fleet of small sailing vessels, which we might utilize should I find it impossible to entice Huja's horde to the mainland. I told Gak what I had written, and suggested that as soon as he could, he should make new treaties with the various kingdoms of the empire, collect an army, and march toward Thuria. This, of course, against the possibility of my detention through some cause or the other. Kolk gave me a sign to his father, a Lidi, or beast of burden, crudely scratched upon a bit of bone, and beneath the Lidi a man and a flower. All very rudely done, perhaps, but nonetheless effective, as I well knew from my long years among the primitive men of Pellucidar. The Lidi is the tribal beast of the Thurians. The man and the flower in the combination in which they appeared bore a double significance, as they constituted not only a message to the effect that the bearer came in peace, but were also Kolk's signature. And so, armed with my credentials and my small arsenal, I set out alone upon my quest for the dearest girl in this world, or yours. Kolk gave me explicit directions, though with my map I do not believe that I could have gone wrong. As a matter of fact, I did not need the map at all, since the principal landmark of the first half of my journey, a giant mountain peak, was plainly visible from Sari, though a good 100 miles away. At the southern base of this mountain a river rose and ran in a westerly direction, finally turning south and emptying into the Sojar Az, some 40 miles northeast of Thuria. All that I had to do was follow this river to the sea, and then follow the coast to Thuria. 240 miles of wild mountains and primeval jungle, of untracked plain, of navelless rivers, of deadly swamps and savage forests lay ahead of me. Yet never had I been more eager for an adventure than now, for never had more depended upon haste and success. I do not know how long a time that journey required, and only half did I appreciate the varied wonders that each new march unfolded before me, for my mind and heart were filled with but a single image, that of a perfect girl whose great dark eyes looked bravely forth from a frame of raven hair. It was not until I passed the high peak and found the river that my eyes first discovered the pendant world, the tiny satellite which hangs low over the surface of Pellucidar, casting its perpetual shadow always upon the same spot. The area that is known here as the Land of Awful Shadow, in which dwells the tribe of Thuria. From the distance and the elevation of the highlands where I stood, the Pellucidarian noonday moon showed half in sunshine and half in shadow, while directly beneath it was plainly visible the dark, brown spot upon the surface of Pellucidar where the sun has never shone. From where I stood, the moon appeared to hang so low above the ground as almost to touch it. But later I was to learn that it floats a mile above the surface, which seems indeed quite close for a moon. Following the river downward, I soon lost sight of the tiny planet as I entered the mazes of a lofty forest. Nor did I catch another glimpse of it for some time, several marches at least. However, when the river led me to the sea, or rather just before it reached the sea, of a sudden the sky became overcast and the size and luxuriance of the vegetation diminished as by magic, as if an omnipotent hand had drawn a line upon the earth and said, "Upon this side shall the trees and shrubs, the grasses and the flowers, riot in profusion of rich colours, gigantic size and bewildering abundance, and upon that side shall they be dwarfed and pale and scant." Instantly I looked above, for clouds are so uncommon in the skies of Pellucidar that they are practically unknown except above the mightiest mountain ranges, and it had given me something of a start to discover the sun obliterated. But I was not long in coming to a realization of the cause of the shadow. Above me hung another world. I could see its mountains and valleys, oceans, lakes and rivers, its broad grassy plains and dense forests. But too great was the distance and too deep the shadow of its underside for me to distinguish any movement as of animal life. Instantly a great curiosity was awakened within me. The questions which the sight of this planet, so tantalizingly close, raised in my mind, were numerous and unanswerable. Was it inhabited? If so, by what manner and form of creature? Were its people as relatively diminutive as their little world? Or were they as disproportionately huge as the lesser attraction of gravity upon the surface of their globe would permit of their being? As I watched it, I saw it was revolving upon an axis that lay parallel to the surface of Pellucidar, so that during each revolution its entire surface was once exposed to the world below, and once bathed in the heat of the great sun above. The little world had that which Pellucidar could not have, a day and night, and greatest of boons to one outer earthly born, time. Here I saw a chance to give time to Pellucidar. Using this mighty clock, revolving perpetually in the heavens, to record the passage of the hours for the earth below. Here should be located an observatory from which might be flashed by wireless to every corner of the empire the correct time once each day. That this time would be easily measured I had no doubt, since so plain were the landmarks upon the undersurface of the satellite, that would be but necessary to erect a simple instrument, and mark the instant of passage of a given landmark across the instrument. But then was not the time for dreaming. I must devote my mind to the purpose of my journey. So I hastened onward beneath the great shadow. As I advanced, I could not but note the changing nature of the vegetation and paling of its hues. The river led me a short distance within the shadow before it emptied into the Sojar Oz. Then I continued in a southerly direction along the coast, toward the village of Thuria, where I hoped to find Gurk and deliver to him my credentials. I had progressed no great distance from the mouth of the river, when I discerned, lying some distance at sea, a great island. This I assumed to be the stronghold of Hujar, nor did I doubt that upon it even now was Dion. The way was most difficult, since shortly after leaving the river I encountered lofty cliffs, split by numerous long, narrow fjords, each of which necessitated a considerable detour. As the crow flies, it is about 20 miles from the mouth of the river to Thuria, but before I had covered half of it I was fagged. There was no familiar fruit or vegetable growing upon the rocky soil of the cliff tops, and I would have fared ill for food had I not a hair broken cover almost beneath my nose. I carried bow and arrows to conserve my ammunition supply, but so quick was the little animal that I had no time to draw and fit a shaft. In fact, my dinner was 100 yards away and going like the proverbial bat when I dropped my six-shooter on it. It was quite a pretty shot, and when coupled with a good dinner, made me quite contented with myself. After eating, I lay down and slept. When I awoke, I was scarcely so self-satisfied, for I had not more than opened my eyes before I became aware of the presence, barely 100 yards from me, of a pack of some 20 huge wolf dogs, the things which Perry insisted upon calling hyenodons. And almost instantaneously I discovered that while I slept, my revolvers, rifle, bow, arrows, and knife had been stolen from me, and the wolf dog pack was preparing to rush me. And on that exciting note, we're going to leave it for tonight. As always, if you'd like to pick up where we're leaving off, you can find the original on Project Gutenberg at the link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Sleepy Time Tales, the podcast designed around a bedtime story to help you to get a restful night. New episodes will be released every Sunday to give you something fresh to help you rest in a new week. But make sure to subscribe in whatever service you use so that you get new episodes whenever they come out. A reminder that the music for tonight is Sweet Nights and Friends by Kumiku. Check out more of their work on their website, which you'll find linked in the show notes. Good night, and sweet dreams.